Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. This week, we have a signed copy of the sumptuous The Lifeboat Courage on Our Coasts to win in our Seascapes competition, and we'll be talking to Nigel Millard. Robert Dunn tells us about his great-grandmother's survival aboard the Laird Line's Rowan in 1921. First this week to the other side of the world, to the Philippines, where fishermen, their boats and their fishing tackle were devastated by Typhoon Haiyan. Dominic McSorley is chief executive of Concern Worldwide. He talked to Seascapes about the plight of the fishermen.
But I guess one of the less reported stories is the impact that this is having on fishing communities. I mean, there's 7,000 islands in the Philippines, and we are working on Panay. It's a very large island with multiple small islands off that. And the level of destruction, and these are tight, vulnerable communities, fishing communities that aren't on the high up on the economic scale as it is. They're one of the more vulnerable populations, and their livelihoods was just simply devastated. Fishing, for these communities, like 90% of their income comes from fishing. And much of it is, you know, they have motorized boats, larger boats, but the bulk of the fishing is done by these manual boats. So these long boats, they take about 2 to 3 people, and they are, you know, they're treasured and they're kind of handed down from generation to generation. And what we certainly saw was that on one island that we visited, you had 170 families. Only 12 houses were left standing. And of the 200 boats, only 20 were usable. And this is devastating, you know, because this means that, first of all, you know, that they simply don't have any way of making income. And a priority for them, even beyond rebuilding a school or beyond rebuilding their house, was assistance to build and repair the boats and get back on the water ASAP. So that's what we're looking at. That's the focus that we have.
And of course, a huge part of the diet in the Philippines is primarily fish anyway. When one looks at the kind of figures that were in your reports of 1,800 vessels out of a total of 2,300 been devastated, that would have a huge knock-on effect right through all the different island communities, because there are so many myriads of islands making up the country that we know as the Philippines.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do think that this, the, you know, the income generation side of this hinges on everything. This is what feeds families. This is what protects them. This is what enables them to go to the health centre. And this is what educates their children. You take that away and they really have nothing. Now, what on the positive side is extraordinary resilience among the Philippine population. An ability to, you know, I saw them picking through stuff, trying to salvage what they had. They're simply saying, give us some of the raw materials, give us the hulk, and we will find ourselves the fishing nets if we have to. We will try and stitch things back together. They are saying, you don't have to do everything for us, you know. And what we're doing is giving out these grants of economic support packages of about €250, which will be enough to rehabilitate, repair, and get them back onto the water as soon as possible. On this one island that we were looking at, the one I was talking about, is about 10 miles off Panay. They had 3 concrete buildings, a school, a church and a health clinic. And that's where they all went to, and they managed to survive. But everything else around that, apart from these 3 buildings, was destroyed, including their boats. But some things the conversations we're having about, and I think, you know, the fishing communities in here would understand this. We're saying we can't, okay, we're committed to providing 2,000 boats, repairing 2,000 boats in the next couple of weeks. But there are more people that need boats. So we're now having conversations saying, can you share? Can we get 2 families to share a boat for the next couple of months? And those are not easy conversations for fishing families. But But they are prepared to do that because many of these communities are all they're closely linked. It's brothers, sisters, families. It is a strong community spirit, and they are looking at sharing facilities, which I think is a tough ask for many fishermen. But they said we're prepared to do this to try and help each other at least for the next couple of months. These islands, many of them are very, very isolated. And in some cases, you know, there isn't even proper water, freshwater supplies on these. And the first thing they were having to do with the boats that were able to sail was not to go out and fish, was actually to go to the mainland and carry back, you know, 20 jerry cans of fresh water. And this is a problem that is going to have to be looked at on a longer term basis. So the boats are critical, not just for income, but absolutely for everything. It links back into everything, and restoring that fast is really a top priority. Ireland, you know, is an island, and there's so many similarities between us and the Philippines in terms of, you know, we are a nation of fishers as well, and I think that the fishing community here will particularly relate to the problems that are being faced by the people of the Philippines, in particular these remote areas where we're working in. So any support that they can give is certainly much appreciated. Times are tough, and times are tough here. So we just say whatever people can afford, and that's all we would expect. But I do think there's really strong connections. You know, being in the Philippines, it was a real privilege and pleasure to see how hospitable people were, how accommodating they were, and how they were determined to try and get themselves back. And they're asking for help for that period to do that. And then they know they're going to have to face this on their own. But the resilience, I think, of the Irish and the resilience of the Philippines, there's a lot of similarities in the spirits. These are tight-knit communities, you know, that go back generations. And there's an extraordinary pride, you know, when it moves from father to son. The men, during the time of the typhoon, the women went up to the shelter and the men went down to protect the boats, right? This is how important these livelihoods were. When it got to such extreme conditions of 300 kilometres an hour, they had to abandon and go back up. And they don't do that easily. These are tough people. Fishermen are tough people anyway by nature. And these families are really close-knit. And I think that community cohesion is really going to give them a sense of drive forward and hope for the future. Christmas is a time, I think, you know, it is a time for thinking of others, family, friends, community, but the broader community. And I think the story of the fishermen is one that we really need to tell and let people hear.
Dominic McSorley of Concern Worldwide. Here on Seascapes, we're mindful that our own fishing communities are seeing their livelihoods threatened by a poor share of the fishing quota and an industry hidebound in regulation. You can find out more and make a donation to Concern and see footage on www.concern.net/boats. Our end-of-year competition here on Seascapes is for a signed copy of the lifeboat Courage on Our Coasts. We want you to tell us the new lifeboat class named after an Irish river and designed by RNLI naval architect Peter Eyre. It features in the book. Answers on a postcard to Seascapes, RTE Radio 1, Father Matthew Street in Cork, or by email to seascapes@rte.ie. The book features the photography of Nigel Millard, whom we met here on Seascapes a few weeks ago. Nigel is known to many lifeboat crews right around our coast. We talked to Nigel about some of the images in the book and the rescue of the Rambler 100 during the Fastnet race.
Incredible to witness. I was spending the week with Baltimore. We'd gone out on exercise to the Fastnet Rock. A yacht passed us doing about 25 knots. And at the time we were in Baltimore's Tyne class boat. They subsequently got a new Tamar. And we couldn't keep up with this boat that passed. Little did we know that that was the Rambler. And we got tasked to an EPIRB. That then turned into a Mayday. And we commenced a 3-hour search for a missing yacht. After 3 hours, breaking seas, quite violent, quite lively seas. We came across the upturned hull of the Rambler 100, £15 million Supermax yacht. The keel had sheared off in about 15 seconds, thrown everybody into the water. Although one guy did manage a dry capsize. He walked around the keel as it came up. He walked around the hull. But we were starting to get the guys off, and they told us that there's five missing. And the helicopters from Shannon and Waterford were scrambled, lifeboats from Cork McSherry, and the inshore lifeboat from Baltimore, along with numerous other vessels, commenced the search. So I'm crew for the day. I'm one of the crew, so I have a camera, obviously. But my first thing is, yes, I'm trying to document this, but it's to the casualties. And so I was looking after first aid. So if everybody was okay as they came on board, I grabbed the camera again and started shooting. And so this shot shows us literally, we've inflated the X boat, which is a little daughter vessel that's carried on board the Tyne class. And we're bringing the guys across one or two at a time. After we'd recovered everybody, the other amazing thing about this was when we found them, these 16 guys were standing on the top of the hull, just like they were waiting for a bus. Professional sailors, not fazed by it, not panicked, knew exactly what they were doing. There's a long way, there's a lot of water in between you and America there. The incredible thing was that it was getting quite dark, and had this have happened 3/4 of an hour later, who knows? But the five crew were found. One of the off-duty lifeboat crew from Baltimore had responded to the Mayday, and he found the guys safe and well. One was slightly hypothermic and was airlifted to hospital. But for me, the images didn't stop there, and the experience didn't stop there, because as we got back to Baltimore, 10:30, 10:45 at night, I think it was, the whole community had come out and were standing around the harbour, and they bought clothing, food, and they'd found shelter for complete strangers. Professional sailors all around the world, they'd lost everything. No money, no passports, no food, nothing. And the sense of community was amazing to witness. Again, for me, the important thing was to photograph fundraisers, crew's kids, crew's wives, coxswains, people that were retired crew, former crew, the whole of the RNLI family. Young faces, old faces, sea-sprayed faces. A good mix of everybody. And just to give a sense of the RNLI family and the RNLI community. Kilmalkey had the first Tamar in Ireland, the Tamar-class lifeboat. And we're doing a rough weather exercise with Ross Lair. And both of the shots that I shot that day are included in the exhibition. Kilmalkey, this image was shot from the back of Ross Lair's boat. And it shows Kilmalkey climbing up a breaking 15-metre wave. A lively day, a lot of water around. I'm strapped on, and I've got crew either side of me strapped on and holding on. But the really important thing about this is that we go out on these rough weather exercises, and it's not just for photographs. It's important that as volunteer crew, we get to train in all different conditions, so that when the pages do go off and it is really lively out there, we know what we're doing, we know how the boat's going to handle, we know how we handle. And so going out on days like that, learning how to use the radar, the chart plotter, steering the boat, getting a feel for the boat in rough weather, just understanding whether you get seasick, whether you feel seasick, all of those things are important.
Respecting the sea, isn't that it?
Indeed, absolutely. And knowing your limitations and knowing your crew's limitations. The image that we're talking about shows one of the crew, a chap called Gary, and he's waving at the crowds. We're passing Sea Containers House, and on the outside is a huge banner showing the royal family on the balcony, and it's a black and white image showing the Queen waving. Gary is in the rib waving. He'd been waving at crowds all day as we were going up and down the river. It was hoofing it down with rain. We were absolutely drenched, even though we're wearing dry suits. It had come through that we'd been, you know, on the water for 12, 14 hours. We were soaked, but humour was high, and we all had a great crack And it was wonderful to witness, a wonderful day. Huge breadth and depth of craft all within a few miles of each other, indeed.
Photographer Nigel Millard. To win that signed copy of the lifeboat Courage on Our Coast, just name that major Irish river that gives its name to the new class of lifeboat. On Christmas Eve, a short ceremony will take place at midday at the lighthouse end of Dunleary's popular East Pier. It will include music, an ecumenical blessing, a contemporary newspaper account of the 1895 tragedy, and a piped lament. The ceremony is a long-standing Christmas Eve tradition that remembers the lives of the 15 volunteer crew that died when their lifeboat capsized in gale force winds while attempting to rescue those on board the SS Palm. It had run aground off Blackrock in County Dublin. All lives lost at sea will also be included in the ceremony.
The sheets were frozen hard and they cut the naked hand. The decks were like a slide where a seaman scarce could stand. The wind was a nor'wester blowing squally off the sea, and the cliffs and spouting breakers were the only things alee.
They heard the surf roaring before the break of day, but 'twas only with the peep of light we saw how well we lay. We tumbled every hand on deck and stamped her with a shout, and we gave her the main topsail and stood by to go about.
All day we tacked and tacked between the south head and the north. All day we hauled the frozen sheets and got no further forth. All day as cold as charity in bitter pain and dread. For very life and nature we tacked from head to head.
We gave the south a wider berth, for there the tide race roared. But every tack we made, we brought the north head close aboard. We saw the cliff and houses and the breakers running high, and the coast guard in his garden with his glass against his eye.
The frost was on the village roofs as white as ocean foam. The blue red fires were burning bright in every longshore home. The windows sparkled clear and the chimneys volleyed out, and I vow we sniffed the victuals as the vessel went about.
The bells upon the church were rung with a mighty jovial cheer.
For it's just that I should tell you how of all days in the year, this day of our adversity was blessed Christmas morn, and the house above the coast guards was the house where I was born.
Oh, well, I saw the pleasant room, the pleasant faces there, my mother's silver spectacles, my father's silver hair. And well, I saw the firelights like a flight of homely elves go dancing round the china plates that stand upon the shelves.
And well, I knew the talk they had, the talk that was of me, of the shadow on the household and the sun that went to sea. And oh, the wicked fool I seemed in every kind of way
to be here and holding frozen robes on blessed Christmas Day.
The Long John's There and Christmas at Sea. Well, some time ago, through a good friend of the programme, Brian Trench, we heard of this next tale of survival, which coincided with a tour by the Southern Syncopated Orchestra. Robert Dunn told us about his great-grandmother, Elizabeth McNair, and her voyage aboard the Laird Line ship, the Rowan, out of Glasgow, bound for Dublin.
And there were always three stories in the family. One was that the family always blamed the late arrival of a band or a theatre performer, as they called them, to causing the sinking of the ship. And the other story was that my great-grandmother listened to her son-in-law and did what he suggested to save herself during the sinking. And the final one is a funny one, where she claimed she never had varicose veins after being in the sea for 4 hours. Well, she was taking the voyage because she was a member of the Scottish community which lived in Dublin, and her father was actually a plumber who came over from Glasgow in the 1850s. But her son-in-law was employed by the Dublin Shipbuilding Company, which was part of Glasgow Shipbuilders, and he was a foreman plater. So she was coming across to help with her daughter, who was having the fourth of the family. And it was like the Ryanair of the time. You got the Laird Line ship between Dublin and Glasgow, just as you got Ryanair between Dublin and Prestwick, as I do. That would be my great-great-grandfather. When he came across, he was an unemployed plumber, and Dublin was growing at the time. But yes, everybody went backwards and forwards, and it was an overnight sailing. That would have been about 1854, but we're not sure on that date. It came about because the ship was late leaving Glasgow. Late leaving Glasgow because the Southern Syncopated Orchestra had been playing in Glasgow and were due to play in Dublin the next day. The ship waited as long as it could. Then it set sail for its next port, which was Girvan. There were a lot of other people, interesting people, on that particular voyage. But having said that, in the summer there were about 1,400 people used to be on it. But in the time it was in October, there were just maybe 200 people, 200 passengers and crew. The orchestra was obviously the main focus of all the news media, because they were very, very famous at that time. They were the first jazz orchestra who toured Europe. They had played in Buckingham Palace in a drained-out lake. The extraordinary set of circumstances were that I suppose you could even go back to the climate of the week. It was a very, very warm, particularly warm week coming up to the weekend. And obviously in October, the sea temperatures are at their highest. But then, of course, the weather gets cold, sea temperature is high, so you get very, very dense fogs. And there was a particularly dense fog at Port Patrick. And the Rowan went into the fog. Now, after that, nobody knows what happened, but apparently an American ship called the West Camock hit it slightly from the rear or to the side. And that caused the passengers to be brought up on deck, as would be standard practice, but on their life jackets. But the captain sent out an SOS, which meant that all the ships in the area, including a Royal Naval Destroyer and including a rather large ship, rushed to the scene. So the Rowan was turning around, basically, to turn into the Irish Sea. And then it got hit from behind by an American ship, the West Camock. That caused the passengers to be brought up on deck, to put on their life jackets, and for the boats to be readied. However, Captain Brown of the Rowan sent out an SOS call, and that caused all ships in the area to speed to his assistance. Unfortunately, the Clan Malcolm was speeding too fast and sliced the Rowan in two as it was going to the rescue. At the same time, a Royal Naval Destroyer was coming onto the scene. But everybody was either thrown into the water or managed, the few that were in the boats, managed to get into the safety of the boats. And then the other story I read about was the destroyer was able to use its floodlights to cut through the fog. Now, who isn't to say if the destroyer had got there first, it might have been a different story which we'd never read about, with no fatalities.
So how is the story related to you within the family? I mean, apart from the Varga Sveins bit, but about spending time in the water, because as you say, the conditions that particular week in 1921 were rather pleasant.
No, it's never pleasant. But again, I think we've got to remember the time that we're at, we expect that safety. In Edwardian times, people expected that they might be shipwrecked at some stage. So my grandfather had advised his mother-in-law that if she was ever thrown into the water, that she should look for something that floats, a piece of wood, a piece of debris. And she did that. The other piece of advice he gave to her was always wear warm clothing. And she was wearing a rather large fur coat. Now, that fur coat saved her in two ways. Number one is, as she went into the water, air got caught, which meant she had a good insulating jacket. As well as that, she had a buoyancy aid. So she was in the water with her fur jacket on, and she managed to see a piece of floating wood. And so she took my grandfather's advice, and that inevitably saved her. The funny thing is that if you read the newspaper reports, she's down as Mr. McNair, not Mrs. McNair. So I'm glad that that was sorted out subsequently. I've looked at everything from the New York Times to the Chicago Tribune to the one I have in front of me here, which is the Ashburton Gazette of New Zealand. And they're all based on Associated Press reports. So the internet of the time was the Associated Press, was the wires. Literally, they were the wires, the telegraph wires. If you think from our family's point of view, there was my grandfather with his three daughters standing on the North Wall Quay, and he gets told by colleagues from the Dublin Dockyard, who heard from a ship that had docked an hour earlier, that the ship that his mother-in-law and the grandmother of his children, had been sunk. And that message had been picked up by a transatlantic liner and relayed back to the ship that had docked in Dublin at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Well, there is a happy ending, but obviously she survived. But I have no details, apart from the fact that most of the survivors would have been taken back to Glasgow and not onto Dublin. But yes, my grandmother produced my aunt on the 21st of October, my aunt Isabel. The detail would have had to have been oral in those days. And in fact, my interest was sparked by oral remembrances from my mother, particularly, as I said earlier, the blaming of the late arrival of the Southern Syncopated Orchestra, the story around the varicose veins. We were made aware of the grabbing of something when you're floating in a shipwreck and warm clothing. That's how it came through.
A remarkable escape in October of 1921, recalled by Robert Dunn. Earlier we learnt about the plight of fishermen and their families in the Philippines. Well, over the Christmas period, seafarers will be at work right around the globe. Dermot Desmond, ship's visitor and communications officer at the Flying Angel Centre at the Mission to Seafarers in Dublin, has this message. The Flying Angel Centre of the Mission to Seafarers, Dublin Port, will open from 1 o'clock to 4 p.m. and from 7 to 9 on Christmas Day to welcome seafarers of any nationality or creed. They wish all their volunteers, a management committee and friends at Stella Maris Apostleship of the Sea and all the people who work in Dublin Port, the stevedores and pilots who support their work through the year. Seafarers who are missing their families at this time are especially welcome at the Flying Angels Centre. Well, that's about it for another year here on Seascapes. We have no programme next Friday night. However, Seascapes returns on Friday the 3rd of January with a Seascapes special on Otway Waller, the man who invented running sails. He was a contemporary of Riddle of the Sands author Erskine Childers and yachtsman Conor O'Brien. We'll be talking to John Waller, who has captured the adventures of his father in the pages of Atlantic Affair. Kieran Devaney has the tale of the Limerick steamer, the Alviarú. So until the new year, all of the Seascapes crew wish you every good wish for the festive season, Nollaig Hunaigh Eve, a peaceful, happy and prosperous new year. Fair winds.